In chapter 2, beginning at verse 9, he says, "Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. And Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it. It was very displeasing to them that someone would come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days, and I rose in the night, I and a few men with me. And I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal in which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well, and on the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall, and then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. And then I said to them, 'You see this bad situation that we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire? Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach.' And I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and about the words the king spoke to me. For they had said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they put their hands to the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' So I answered them and I said to them, 'The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore we, his servants, will rise and build. But you have no portion, right or memorial, in Jerusalem.'" You may be seated. When there is need of a revival, or there is a mountain that needs to be moved, God will work in the hearts of people. As we've seen in the testimony of Nehemiah, having heard the testimony or the word about Jerusalem, that he cared so intently that he wept. Not only did he weep, but he prayed and he asked God and he said, "God, if somehow you might use me and my position to do something for this situation." We saw not only did Nehemiah wait, but last week, we saw last week that he waited on God. That eventually the time came and the opportunity came for him to have his audience before the king. And when he spoke to the king, or actually the king spoke to him, the king opened up and said to him, "Nehemiah, I'm giving it to you. I'm going to send you, I'm going to give you the authority, and I'm going to give you the provisions that you need to fulfill the project that God has put in your heart." Folks, this was an act of God. For the king to be that sensitive to his cupbearer who had been sat in his presence, which was against the law, and for Nehemiah to come and to describe to him the things that he needed was simply an act of faith. And then he found how God and his infinite mercy and love opened up the king's heart so that the king was sensitive to Nehemiah. And of course, the study that we saw last week was that where God guides, God provides. And he said this in verse 8. He said, "And the king granted these things to me because the good hand of my God was with me." What he was saying is this: God was in this thing. The king acting like he did was a green light. It was a green light from God. And when he got this green light from the king, he received it as a green light from God, because only God could have opened up these doors for him. Now it was time for Nehemiah to walk through the open doors that God had given to him. What an awesome thing it is when we know for certain that it's God who is bringing us in a certain direction and we respond to God. And we see the doors that are open. I think of Jesus speaking to the Philadelphia church. He said, "Behold, I put before you an open door which no one can shut." In other words, I am opening the door, and because I am opening the door, there is no one who can shut the door. And what a great place it is when we are in such a position that God says, I am presenting you this door and it's open. And there's no one that can shut it. So Nehemiah in verse 9, he says, Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me officers of the army and horsemen. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Here we find God had opened up the doors for Nehemiah and he was on the move. He had letters in hand. These letters that he carried with him would no doubt give him safety for his journey. They were letters from the king himself that said, Nehemiah, I am giving authority. These letters meant authority, they meant provision. And the officers coming with Nehemiah were as good as the king's signature, saying, if you fight against Nehemiah, you are fighting against the king. And so Nehemiah set out in his journey, and how awesome to realize that the praying, the fasting, the waiting on God had not been in vain, as in fact it will never be in vain when you spend your time with God and seek His counsel and His will. But notice here that in the setting of this movement of faith, and as he steps out, that you see Nehemiah is immediately faced with this concept or this force of opposition. You see, the coming of Nehemiah was good news for a lot of people. It was good news for those who were distressed and discouraged and despondent and were aching inside, but the news of Nehemiah's coming was not good news for everyone. And immediately we discover that there is opposition to the plan of God that was laying out. And these two characters come forward. One is named Sanballat, the Horonite. Now he is the governor of Samaria, which is just north of Jerusalem. It is a region to the north. You read about Samaria when you get into the New Testament. And it was this place that the Jews had been exiled from, brought into captivity by Assyria, and they displaced this particular place with peoples from all over the region. Now, a Horonite would be somebody who is from Moab. So here we have Sanballat, he's from Moab, and we have Tobiah, who is the Ammonite. Now, if you know your Bible, you know your Old Testament, you recognize that both Ammon and Moabites had been a force against Israel many times in the Old Testament. And both Sanballat and Tobiah had made their way at this point in prominence. They had positions, they were in authority. They had, in fact, become the kings of the hill. This news of restoration was not welcome news. I want you to notice something here, is that there will always be many who will not welcome the news of building or rebuilding or of change. There will always be those who, quite frankly, are simply satisfied and content with the way things are. There will always be those who will be threatened by the rebuilding or the restructuring of something that has been torn down. There will always be those who want every apple on the apple cart to stay right exactly where it is. Opposition, even in the plan of God, ought to be expected when we take our step of faith with the Lord. Because right off the bat here, we see that Nehemiah was faced with the fact that not everyone was welcoming his coming. There were enemies, and their greatest ambition would be to make sure that he did not accomplish the purpose of God that he had set out for. There were enemies who liked these walls being torn down. They were content with things just the way they were. You know, and I don't know why we would ever think that moving in the purpose of God would mean that we would not face opposition. Every move of God flies in the face of opposition. It was certainly true of the New Church, New Testament church, wasn't it? Because as soon as the church was established, opposition broke out against them. Great persecution. And the very first scenes you find of the disciples after Pentecost is what? They are in jail answering to the Sanhedrin. Not very long after, there were those who were being martyred, James. You see, what we do is we tend to assume that perhaps opposition means that maybe God isn't in this thing after we've taken the step of faith. I mean, it's easy to think when things don't go as smoothly as we thought they should go, that perhaps maybe God is really not in this thing and maybe it's time to quit. You see, opposition is a certainty when mountains are to be moved. And there are always going to be a certain amount of people who like the mountain right where it is. They don't want it to go anywhere. churches live in a state of deadness and fear because they're afraid of growth, they're afraid of new leaders, they're afraid of change. Just keep things, leave well enough alone. Let me keep my position. You see, when you're the king of the hill, this whole idea of change and growth and restructuring is a threat to you. But any movement of God always ruffles the feathers of the enemy. Don't expect the enemy to sit idly by while God begins to do a great work. Don't expect the enemy to take the advancement of the kingdom of God easily and take it laying down. Because when God moves, when God guides and God is providing, the enemy will also be moving as well. It isn't long after creation that we saw the enemy moving in on those perfect creatures, Adam and Eve. Now here's the point. Opposition is no indication that we are on the wrong course. In fact, it may be the very evidence that we have ruffled someone's feathers for the things of God happening. I think about this past week as we were watching the confirmation of the Attorney General and the flack. There's a lot of people who, quite frankly, like things just the way they are. They've been set as the king of the hill. They like where the walls that have been torn down, and they are fearful and they are threatened of walls being rebuilt that they have torn down. Opposition should be no surprise to anyone. Ever notice how plain Jesus was about this? And Jesus said this to his disciples, "No servant is greater than his master. If they have persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also." Paul, writing to Timothy, he said, in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. You will have opposition. I think of in my own ministry. Last week I shared the testimony of the beginnings of our church. And we saw the greatness of how God was opening up doors, and it was very obvious that God was in this thing. From being in a small home and gathering together and watching the Lord open up the doors for our first building and watch the Lord moving. But it wasn't long after we were into the building and things began to happen that opposition came my way. I began to get threats by different people who didn't like the counsel that I gave them. Even threats on my life. And I remember some of the greatest disappointments were the little notes that I would get from people and the anonymous letters that I would get from people saying, "Hey man, you gotta just bag this whole thing and get out of the ministry." And I never knew who they were. They were people inside of our congregation somewhere. I never understood it. And the opposition was hard, it was difficult, it was painful to go through. But how I thank God that during that period of time that He gave me enough grace and enough people around me to encourage me, that I would hang in there. Because the disappointment was there, I thought, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I ought to just quit this thing. You see, someone doesn't like the change. Someone doesn't want to build. Someone is going to be threatened by the growth that takes place. I think about this even in the context of marriage. What in the world would ever make anyone think that a good marriage wouldn't have opposition? Because when God is moving, always expect opposition. And by those things, we are strengthened in our walk. It is by the very trials themselves that a marriage is strengthened. Jenna and I were just celebrating our 22nd anniversary yesterday. And our first 5 years were miserable. But here we are 22 years later looking at each other saying, wasn't God good to bring us together? And there's been a lot of opposition. There's been things that we have gone through together, opposition in our marriage. But God has always been faithful to us. And the opposition we would never assume meant that we weren't to be together. No, it simply meant that God was going to do something with us in our marriage. It is said of William Wilberforce that he pushed Britain's Parliament to abolish slavery. And he got so discouraged that he was about to give up. And so his friend, his dear old friend, John Wesley, he heard about his discouragement. He heard about that he was ready to give up. And at the time, John Wesley was on his deathbed. So he wrote him a letter, and he said this to him. He said, "Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God is before you, who can be against you? Are all of them stronger than God? Oh, be not weary in well-doing. Go on in the name of God and the power of His might till the American slavery shall vanish away before it." What is interesting is that Wesley died just 6 days later. But Wilberforce fought 45 more years, and in 1833, 3 days before his death, he saw slavery abolished in Britain. I think of this story of the Apostle Paul, where he writes about his tribulations. He says, "What is more, I've labored far more than anyone, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and day I've spent in the deep. I have been in frequent journeys, in danger in rivers, danger of robbers, dangers for my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers at sea, dangers among false brethren, through many sleepless nights and hunger and thirst, often without food and cold and exposure." Paul said, "I have known opposition." I think of the story, if you look at the Apostle Paul, even when he was heading to Jerusalem. He was given the counsel by others who had been shown by God that when he went into Jerusalem that he would be taken captive there and that they would seek to put him to death. What is interesting about the Apostle Paul is not once did he ever suggest or think to himself that perhaps he was out of the will of God because things were not going as smoothly as he thought they should go. There was always going to be opposition, because when God moves, the enemy moves. It is well said that God is the head of the missionary movement and the devil heads the opposition. Opposition was not an indication that Nehemiah was on the wrong course. Listen, folks, there are times in your life when the wind is going to be at your back and you're going to be in the headwinds at the same time. When it feels like a whirlwind around you, and Nehemiah was being moved by God, but it didn't mean that opposition wouldn't come his way. So in verse 11 he says, "So I came to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. And I rose in the night, and I and a few men with me, and I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate, into the direction of the Dragon's Well, and on the refuge gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down, and its gates which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went on at night by the ravine to inspect the walls. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned, and the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. Nor has I yet told the Jews, the priests and the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work." I want you to note the course that Nehemiah takes in the face of opposition. When he arrives in Jerusalem, there is no fanfare. There is no parading of himself, "Here I am to save the day." There is no savior complex. "Wonderful me, people come out. Yes, I realize you're discouraged, but now you've got someone here who can take up your case for you." In fact, he says here that he didn't even let anyone know what his purpose was. In other words, it was LP, low profile. And then by night, for several days and nights, he would quietly begin to go out and assess the situation and to begin to confirm to himself the reports that he had heard and what brought him there in the first place. I want you to take a note here that good leaders are often awake while others are sleeping. They're often working while others are resting. But he quietly assessed and he waited. Why? Because the Bible tells us that a wise man is one who first counts the cost. Before he sets his hand to the plow and knows that there will be no turning back, he makes sure that he has what he needs to go forward. All this time, he says, God was putting into my mind what could be done for Jerusalem. In other words, Nehemiah was still in prayer. He was still getting his marching orders from God. He was still phoning home to get directions. The very thing that Jesus would do, often withdrawing to lonely places, he would seek God. And he'd get the direction that he would need to move on. And what Nehemiah needed most was wisdom. The thing I love about Nehemiah and the example that he gives to us, it is much better to think and to reason before you act and speak. Proverbs 18:13 says, "He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him." Waiting, thinking, planning, praying are always better to do before you act. I have discovered over the years that there are many who come and they'll tell you all the wonderful things that they plan on doing. They will tell you again and again and again, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And as years go on, they're still coming to you and they're still telling you, I'm going to do this. There are others who don't say a word, they just begin plotting the course. And by and large, they're the ones who get the job done. They move quietly. And the first step we see here in his leadership is that he comes to investigate the situation, and it must have been overwhelming for him. As reported, and he moved from gate to gate and from the walls and saw them all torn down, I wonder how many times his heart was broken as he really saw how bad it was for himself. As he moved to the king's pool and the fountain gate, this place that was once so magnificent, so beautiful, so glorious, and he looked and he says, it was so bad I had to get off my mountain and walk my horse. It was not even a place to walk. After 150 years, still such ruin and decay. There was so much ruin, there was so much rubble, there was no place to even pass by a horse. And it was after these things that Nehemiah went to the people. After he investigated, in verse 17, then I said to them, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. After his investigation and assessing the damage came the time now to pass on the mission. Because it's something else that a leader knows. He knows the importance of cooperation. A good leader understands that it's going to take others, and it's his ability then to pass on the vision. By himself, Nehemiah knew that what he saw in his whole scope was impossible for him to do with his own two hands. The impossibility just faced him, I'm sure, every single night, as much as he wanted to, as much as he would desire to, it would be impossible for him to do this by himself. No, this vision needed to be passed on to others. It needed cooperation. And good leaders will always get others moving. They pass the vision along. And what makes a leader is that others are following. And if there is no one following you, then you are not leading. Then you are a follower. Someone defined leadership as the art of getting people to do what they ought to do because they want to do it. How foolish it is for any pastor or supposed leader to believe that the mission of the church is his lone mission. Because a good leader, he gets others going, each using the gifts for a common purpose. There is no more beautiful sight in all the world than when you watch the people begin to cooperate. When they come together under purpose and vision, when people's visions and burdens are laid out, and they pass those visions on, instead of sitting back and thinking all that the pastor should do or the church should do, and there's a lot of people like that, this is what they should do here, and this is what they should do. No, how awesome it is when you see people to step out in the burdens that God has given to them. And instead of spectating, they get busy. There is no end in sight to what can be accomplished. A couple of weeks ago, our leadership from the church, about 35 of us got together, and we spent a night together in most of a day on a Saturday. And we simply share what our year was like. This is all the heads of the different ministries. And we share the vision of what's going to happen in the next year and the different parts of each ministry. And as you sit there and you're going through this whole thing, it's almost overwhelming. You're almost, is this all that is going on in our fellowship? You mean this is going on over here? And you almost sit there stunned thinking, look at all that's being done. Why? Because vision is being passed along. People are stepping out and they're doing what God has given them to do, and they're passing the vision on to others and leaderships. Leaders raise up other leaders and they raise up other leaders, and pretty soon you get this great work of God going on. Which by and large is one of the struggles I have with a megachurch, because the megachurch tends to have the professional leaders and leaves the people simply coming and doing nothing. The Bible has no mention of this. In fact, New Testament teaching is Ephesians 4:11, and he gave some as apostles, some as prophets, some as evangelists, some as pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the building up of the body of Christ. My vision, people, is to make sure that I see Christians grow and discover your vision. What really gets my blood cranking and moving, What really gets it flowing is when I see you growing and I watch you take the steps of what God has brought into your life and the vision that He has given to you. And when I see those things, my heart is thrilled because that's the vision that God has put in my heart. Here's Nehemiah. He's just the man for the job because he's a leader. 150 years, the city had lay in ruin. It had been 90 years since the first exiles had returned. And the testimony for these 90 years was opposition. Opposition to rebuilding, and this place lay in ruin, and it was embarrassment to the people, and it needed someone fresh to come with a fresh purpose and to remind the people of the hope that they had. Now again, I want you to notice with me, as we saw in the prayer of Nehemiah, as he talks to the people, you have to take note of the pronouns that he uses as he speaks. He says, "You see the situation, this bad situation we are in." Notice that. Not the situation you are in, but the situation we are in, self-included. In other words, he is saying to them, your problem is now my problem. It is our problem. These walls are a disgrace, not to you, they are a disgrace to us. Jerusalem, the city, our city. And he wasn't telling them anything that they didn't know. They knew they were in distress. But what these people needed to know is that their hopes could still be alive. They needed someone to come to them and say, this is where we are, this is where we are living, but this is where we should be, and this is how we can get there. Someone had to lead if the job was ever going to get done. And so Nehemiah's counsel is this. Let us do something about this. Not let you do something about this, but let us get together and let's do something about the situation that we get. Come, let us rebuild. We. Let's do it. Let us rid ourselves of the reproach. So in verse 18 he says, I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their good hands to good work. Not only did Nehemiah pass along the vision, he inspired them. He gave them the assurance that God was in this thing, and I'm sure he just began to recount the whole story of his audience with the king. I'm sure he said, you know what, people, his most weird thing happened. I showed up for work one day, and the king noticed me. It was a normal day, and the king asked me what was wrong with me, and I told him what was wrong with me. And not only did the king himself let me come to Jerusalem, he sent me here to Jerusalem. And not only did he send me here to Jerusalem, he gave me authority here in Jerusalem. And not only did he give me authority here in Jerusalem, he gave me all the provisions that I needed to do the job. In other words, I was sent here by the king to do this. God is in this thing. And the people, they were so inspired that look how they responded. They said, okay, let us arise and build. There's no mention here of, well, we tried this before. And we've done this before. And every single time we do, someone comes up against it. It's time to build. Let us build. That's a response. And you wonder, what in the world had taken them so long? Why had all these years gone by for such a time like this? I'll tell you this. It takes the mercy and the grace of God to get a work like this going. And it all begins when someone cares. It all begins when God works in someone's heart enough to care, to weep, to pray, and to wait, and to act. And then this situation that has been bad for so long, something can change in it. And nothing is ever going to get done until someone cares. In verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and they despised us and they said, what is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Notice that the inspiration of the people didn't go too well with the opposition. They were not too thrilled about what they heard. Nehemiah was there, ready to lead them. The people were ready to follow. And the opposition was growing. Now Geshem the Arab is involved and surrounded by skeptics. These kings of the hill were threatened. They were content to see the walls right where they were. Notice here the first attack was not a physical attack, but it was a powerful and an effective one, or would have been an effective one had God's grace not been with them. And it came the things that we hate and we fear the most. Rejection. Being despised. Being mocked. Insulted. Laughed at. What are you doing? Who in the world are you? What difference do you think you could make? And then you have the false accusations, these charges of treason, an attempt to place you into fear and into doubt. Don't you know that if you start doing this thing, everything's going to break out against you? We hate being laughed at. We hate because we feel like we are intelligent people. Why would anybody laugh at me? We hate being insulted. We hate being mocked. We hate being hated. We hate the thought of being hanged for treason. And by nature, we are filled with fear and insecurity. And it is because of this very reason that many walls still lay down and lay in its ruin. Our fear. And it's been a tactic that the enemy uses, and he uses it daily in your lives. When you're at work, and you have the opportunity to share Jesus with somebody, the opposition comes and says, don't you know they will laugh at you? Don't you want them to think that you are intelligent? That you're not so foolish to believe in such a God who would do such things? Don't you know that they will mock you, that they will scourge you, that the enemy will come against you, that if you do this thing, all hell will break out against you? Don't you know that? And it's been a very effective tool in many of our lives, hasn't it? Fear and insecurity, being laughed at, or having our pride insulted. These opposers came with all the tactics of words. I love Nehemiah's response in verse 20. He says, so I answered them and I said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we His servants will arise and will build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. Notice how he responds. Not by ignoring them, not by retribution, and not by debate. He doesn't come back and say, oh, you're so wrong. All he does is he looks at his enemies and he gives them a straight and direct answer. He says, listen, God of heaven is in this thing and we will build. He will give us success. And because God is with us, nothing can be against us. With strength and confidence, Nehemiah responded to the people, we are getting to work and we will arise and build. And when it is finished, you will have no part in it. Because the walls will separate you from us. You'll be on the outside. And that's the truth. There's a verse in Psalms that says this. Psalms 107:23. Those who go down to the sea in ships, who do business in great waters, they have seen the works of the Lord and His wonders in the deep. Nehemiah entered the waters to do business in great waters. And he would see the works of the Lord and the wonders of the deep as he would take his steps for the Lord. Over the years, I remember the beginning of our fellowship, there was many who said, you build and then we'll come. Get all the work done, then we'll come and be part. How I thank God for every person that hung in there. They got to see things and witness things that the other people never saw. There's always those who are going to hang out on the sidelines, who are going to laugh and ridicule and discourage while the building is being built. But when the building is done, they have no part in it. Nehemiah said to these guys, we will build. It's going to happen. I think of Jesus speaking to Peter. He says, and upon this rock I will build my church. and the gates of hell will not overpower it. He says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Jesus said, the church, I will build it. It's not if or whenever, it's I will do this thing. The church belongs to Him, and He gives us authority, and He gives us the power to accomplish it all. And with Him, we can't lose. Romans 8:31, if God is for us, who can be against us? And Paul, speaking to the Corinthians, says, therefore, my brethren, beloved, be steadfast and immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. In other words, yes, there is going to be opposition, even when God guides. There will be opposition when God is moving. Expect opposition, but expect God to work also. See what God does. You see, the enemy says, leave well enough alone. Don't stir the waters. This situation, it's dead. And I want you to see what Nehemiah says. No, if God is with us, who can be against us? We are people of controversy. Our faith in Jesus sets us aside in a degenerate world. But the testimony is this, if God be for us, who can be against us? Let's pray.